Howard State versus Keith Cuff. Can we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Ms. Larry, please go ahead.
Your Honors, and may it please the Court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
There are two issues in this case, the omission of second-degree kidnapping from the verdict sheet and the imposition of consecutive sentences. I'd like to take each in turn. To begin with the omission of second-degree kidnapping from the verdict sheet.
There's a little competition for the noise, so if you can keep your voice up.
Yeah, I couldn't catch that.
First, I just want to contextualize what exactly happened in this case. The jury was properly orally charged on both first-degree kidnapping and second-degree kidnapping. But the verdict sheet had one kidnapping question that was first-degree kidnapping because it had all three elements of first-degree kidnapping. What distinguishes first- and second-degree kidnapping is that third element, released unharmed before apprehension. Then the verdict sheet asks yes, no about whether Mr. Cuff was armed, which is not relevant in a kidnapping case, and then went on to present other lesser-included criminal restraint and false imprisonment. During deliberations, the jury asked, how do we denote second-degree in the verdict book? And the judge told them to answer the questions as they are posed on the verdict sheet and not to be concerned about the degree of the crime. So there are three questions that need to be answered to assess this omission. The first is, what does this omission mean for jury deliberations? What's the practical effect of this omission? The second is, was it harmful? And the third is, what is the proper remedy? So to begin with the first, the effect of this omission was that it prevented the jury from returning a verdict on second-degree kidnapping. That means the jury was not able to convict Mr. Cuff of second-degree kidnapping. And that's tantamount to not charging that lesser included to begin with. The state has argued that the fact that the jury was orally instructed somehow cures this error, as though the jury had some other way to return this verdict. And that argument fails for two reasons. The first is just reality. Anyone here who has been in a trial knows that the jury returns a verdict through the verdict sheet, and the jury was told on page 8 of the December 17th transcript when it asked how to denote second degree, you answer the questions as they are posed on the verdict sheet, okay? Each individual question is posed. So the idea that the jury had some sort of ability to answer a question not on the sheet just blinkers reality. And the second is what the judge told the jury about the verdict sheet, which is part of the charge, as this court said in Galicia, it's part of that roadmap. On page 102 of the December 10th transcript, for instance, the judge said, the law I gave you on lesser included, I think will make more sense once you see the verdict sheet. So any confusion you have from the oral instruction will be clarified by this verdict sheet. And what did the verdict sheet do? Omit second degree kidnapping. And also, when the judge was going through the verdict sheet on December 10th, pages 107 to 108, he gave the jury a binary. If you find Mr. Cuff guilty of kidnapping without explaining either degree, either form of kidnapping, put guilty on that question. So a jury that was listening to the instructions and doing exactly what it was told would think, if I find him guilty of either form of kidnapping, we say guilty to the only form presented to us. And then
isn't that position belied by the third question of the kidnapping charge, where it required the jury to find, and of course the instruction told them that the state had to prove that the victim was not released unharmed and in a safe place. So with the burden on the state to prove that element and the jury being asked to have to find that in order to check off guilty, then are we really sure that the practical effect that you're concerned about happened here?
I think so, because especially when you look at what the judge said, any ambiguity, anything you don't understand is cleared up in this verdict sheet that only contains one option for kidnapping, which is first degree kidnapping.
Couldn't it equally be that they would have had to find not guilty to that charge?
Well, I think this goes to maybe my next point, which is harm, because I think that's always the question with an omitted lesser included. It doesn't matter unless there was a rational basis, right?
And was there a rational basis? It appears that not one of those victims was released at all, let alone in a safe place. So where is your rational basis?
Yes, okay. That is, I think, the heart of this case. I do want to say first to Justice LaVecchia's point and then to transition to your point, Justice Patterson, the danger from since Sloan, since Warren, the danger this court has recognized for decades is that when given a choice of over-convicting or under-convicting because an appropriate lesser included is missing, the jury over-convicts. The jury rounds up. That's the harm.
So based on what? On what do you base it?
That's
the argument that the jury rounds up rather than down.
That's the premise of this court's lesser included jurisprudence since the 80s.
No, I thought we've said they'll round up or they'll round down. And in this particular case, they may have rounded down in a couple of instances.
Well, I think
that still doesn't necessarily minimize your argument because the jury should never be given an all or nothing.
Right. Well, so this jury, if they thought he was guilty of kidnapping, either could acquit him of kidnapping entirely or convict him of the higher kidnapping.
But he was acquitted of a bunch of kidnappings. And he may have been acquitted of kidnappings because the jury was given this all or nothing.
Maybe.
First degree kidnapping or not second degree kidnapping. And for all we know, and we're entirely speculating, is that they were compromising on various ones.
I think the lesson from this court's jurisprudence is the risk of rounding up is the intolerable choice for a defendant, and the risk of not having an accurate verdict is a problem for the public, which also has an interest in the accurate verdict. So the question is, did we need a second-degree kidnapping charge? I think that really is the heart.
Why don't you start by giving us the plain language meaning of the word release?
So there is no definition of the word release in the model charge. For the purpose of the kidnapping charge, I believe that release is the opposite of confinement. It's the removal of the confining force, because the confinement is what makes something a kidnapping. So the definition that I think makes most sense is release is the removal of the confining force. I think that in a charge that should be given, that I have taken the liberty of drafting something that would be the kind of explanation a jury should receive, the jury should be told something like, release is the removal of the confining force. In determining whether the victim was released, you must consider if the confining force was a physical restraint, verbal threat, deception, and that's from 13.1, the different kinds of confinement, and or the presence of the perpetrators. If there are physical restraints, you should consider how and when those physical restraints were removed. So I think that is the concept of release that is embraced by the definition of confinement.
So what does confining force mean?
So the what
now, tell a jury of lay people what that means.
So 13.1 asks the jury to think, how are these people confined? And it gives the options of deception, force, or threat. But the question is, what is keeping these people in the space they have been moved to, right? So to take a spectrum, on one end of the spectrum, we can have someone who is handcuffed to a radiator. The physical force, the handcuffing, is clearly what's keeping them confined. On the other end of the spectrum, we could have someone put in their bedroom with the door closed. They're staying in that bedroom because the perpetrators are still in the home, but they're obviously not physically unable to exit that door. So that, I think, is kind of the spectrum of ways from most force to least force that someone can be confined. And the question here, this quintessential jury question, is what was confining the victims and when were they released?
With respect to the Gola children, didn't the defendant concede that there was no release?
I'm not sure. Where do you think that occurred?
Was there contested testimony on that?
I don't think so. The defense focused on misidentification. Neither side really focused on the degrees of the crime, is my reading of the transcript, openings, closing, cross, because either he did it or he didn't do it, but that doesn't relieve the jury of the obligation it has to decide what it is.
Your argument is there was a rational basis. And in fact, the judge charged the jury on second degree.
So let's talk about the rational basis, because everyone agreed, the prosecutor, the defense, the judge, because it was charged. Mr. Gola, in his own words, unbound himself immediately.
Where were the zip ties applied?
Just the hands.
In front or behind?
Behind. Just the hands behind. The feet were not bound. The feet and hands were not bound to each other. And he said his own words from the transcript as he escaped immediately. And seconds later, he was in his children's bedroom. They were also bound only in their hands. We don't know if it's in front or behind. So I'm not arguing that no rational jury could convict Mr. Cuff of first-degree kidnapping. I am not arguing that. But that's not the question. The rational basis test, as this court reaffirmed recently in Alexander, sets a low threshold for the defense to get a charge. And, as this court said in Mauricio, the evidence has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the defense.
Could a rational jury conclude that two children left with their hands bound behind their backs, and ultimately were not able to get those off themselves. They required an adult's help, were released.
Well, I have two responses to that.
Okay.
I mean, yes is going to be my global answer.
Okay.
It's the state's burden. It's not the defendant's burden to prove that they were released unharmed.
Understand the burdens, but we're talking about two young children, or I think, what, 13 and 12, something
yes,
like that?
Yes, or 13 and 14.
13 and 14, who are left in a room with their hands tied behind their backs with zip ties.
So there's very little evidence presented about the children, right? And so we don't know why
Are you saying that when Mr. was able to release himself, mm-hmm. that he was not left? In other words, if you're left bound, but you're able to release yourself, even though the individual that bound you has gone, that they're not left in that position?
I think a rational jury could find that the state failed to disprove unharmed release here, that it's more akin to being left behind a closed door.
You're including into unharmed release that you release yourself. The defendant leaves you bound, leaves, and then you're able to release yourself. So you're saying that that's part of being left unbound and being
released?
I think
it's part of the factual circumstances that in the totality the jury has to consider. Again, if someone's left behind a closed door, they can open the door and walk out, right? But at that moment, they are behind a door.
But if you're left handcuffed with a zip tie, whatever, and you're able to release yourself somehow going to the kitchen to get a knife or something, that means because you're able to release yourself and the argument you're making today, you were not left bound.
I think it depends, and this is why this is a quintessential jury question, how quickly he got out, if it was by design or by accident. If you happen to tie up MacGyver in the most difficult set of knots you can possibly imagine and handcuffs, and he emerges immediately, maybe a jury wouldn't say, hey.
Did anyone object? The defendant's not releasing him.
You're releasing yourself is my point.
Is releasing himself.
I understand.
That's not what the statute says.
Respectfully, I think the statute asks if the confining force was removed.
Did anyone object to this charge? Did the state object to the court charging second-degree kidnapping?
No.
So everyone at the trial level thought that second-degree kidnapping was an appropriate charge to go to the jury?
Yes. Okay. And I would also just note, and I know I said this before, but the reason it matters that it's the state's burden to disprove unharmed release is we just don't know very much about what happened in this case. We don't know very much about what happened with the children other than they were bound by their hands. We don't know, and that lack of information could lead a jury to say, I'm not sure the state has carried its burden here.
So it's not just the release, it's release of the victim unharmed.
Yes.
Can you address what the record reveals about whether any of the victims were unharmed, emotionally, physically, psychologically?
So physically, we have, and everyone has agreed, even the trial court at sentencing, there seems to be no physical injuries in this case. There's no evidence of any physical injuries. Emotionally, this and all kidnappings are obviously quite traumatizing. The appellate division in Sherman made clear that that harm to elevate it to first degree has to be beyond what's inherent in an ordinary kidnapping. And because the children didn't testify, again, it's really hard for the state to meet that burden. Mr. Gola testified that they were scared but fine, mostly, the perpetrators chit-chatted with them.
I thought you were conceding that the jury could convict.
Absolutely.
On first degree. You're not arguing with there's sufficient evidence. Your
no,
argument
absolutely not.
Is they should have also been charged with second degree.
Absolutely. But in terms of harm, if we're looking at rational basis, if someone was stabbed, right, we could say there's no rational basis to find they had been released unharmed. That's a harm, a physical harm, right? So I'm just trying to make clear that we don't have on this record anything that this court could say, as a matter of law, no rational jury
but
could
can,
find.
Can I focus on the first part? If you release yourself, the actor did not release you in any way. Maybe he did a bad job of tying the knots. He wasn't very good, wasn't a sailor. Maybe the zip tie he used was kind of thin and the guy was pretty strong, but the statute says if the actor releases the victim, if you release yourself, the actor's not releasing you in any way.
Well, again,
and you're arguing that if you release yourself, it's second degree.
I think an appropriate model charge could add, after the part that I read, the jury should consider whether the release was luck or due to the perpetrator's decision-making.
But that's not in the statute. How can a jury charge go beyond what the statute says, which is it says clearly if the actor releases the victim, nothing about the victim releasing themselves or the actor did a bad job of binding them?
The question again is what is the confining force? If someone's behind an unlocked door, to say that when the person walks away from the house, that person behind the door wasn't released because the door wasn't opened.
Yeah, but that's not what we have here.
No, there's a spectrum. And that's why this is a jury question. That's my fundamental point that I keep returning to.
Did anybody object to the verdict sheet? Nobody objected to the charge, and nobody, not even the defense, objected to the verdict sheet.
I know. And I'm here often when people aren't objecting to things, and that's unfortunate and frustrating. But what we do have is everyone agreed that this charge is appropriate, and the verdict sheet clearly prevented the jury from returning the charge. So we have to ask, is that clearly capable of causing an unjust result?
Well, actually, the verdict sheet required that they acquit they don't find what you're suggesting
technically,
they didn't find.
But what we have recognized throughout the decades is juries are liable to resolve their doubts, especially because they were...
But don't we also say juries are presumed to follow the charge?
Yeah.
Juries are presumed to do what they're instructed to do by the judge.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge instructed them that they need to find the third element to convict. It's not, if they don't find it and it's not on the verdict sheet, they're acquitting. I mean, you're asking us to change our jurisprudence about what juries do and don't do in response to jury charges.
This jury, if it followed the instructions it was given, would know that Mr. Cuff maybe was guilty of only second-degree kidnapping because it was told about second-degree kidnapping. So if it thought that was the right charge, and just to read you what the trial court said on page 107 of December 10th, with kidnapping again, this is not guilty or guilty. So the way, for instance, on question 19 with Mr. Cuff, 19A is kidnapping, binary kidnapping, guilty or not guilty. And then on the 17th, the jury was told that degrees are the court's domain. So this jury, properly orally instructed, thinking Mr. Cuff was guilty of second degree, listening to what the trial court told them about the verdict sheet and about degrees and about the different degrees of kidnapping, would return a verdict for first degree kidnapping, I think, if they were properly following the law.
That's your conclusion.
Yes, and I do think that if you review all of the instructions, not just the oral instructions about the offenses, but then go through the instructions on the verdict sheet, you'll see how a jury that thought it's kidnapping, it's not false imprisonment, it's not criminal restraint, it's kidnapping, would still be compelled to return a first-degree kidnapping charge because that's the only kidnapping available.
Well, you also have the question raised by the jury. If applicable,
yes.
How do we denote second-degree on a charge in the verdict book? And the judge just said, look at whatever is on the verdict sheet, that's it.
And the degree is the court's domain, right? So do not worry about this. The jury would say, okay, we'll convict of kidnapping, and then the degree is the court's domain. The court will figure out which degree it is. And we have another clue left by the jury, which is the verdict sheet. You know, clearly they were struggling with first-degree kidnapping. When you look on the markings on that verdict sheet, originally they marked not guilty. Maybe that's not dispositive. I could understand.
Well, we can't consider. I mean, really, is there any authority whatsoever for looking at the markings on
yes.
verdict sheet? Okay,
I have
fire
one.
Away.
When I have one. Uh-oh. Nelson. So Nelson was a capital case.
Nelson.
Leslie Nelson?
Yes, capital case. Where the verdict sheet was a little confusing about unanimity for an aggravator. And this court said, the verdict sheet's ambiguous wording, coupled with the jury's clearly confused response to the special verdict instruction, and the failure for the trial court to obtain clarification for the jury, demonstrates trial court error, which we cannot consider harmless. Now, capital verdict sheets are a little different because they obviously had to show their work in this very specific way that juries now don't have to show their work.
But was it random markings in that case?
No, it was more specific.
I should have asked a more precise question. I understand that you look at verdict sheets and you look at the sequence and see if it actually makes sense going forward. But in terms of crossouts,
in that case,
doodles that appear, the foreperson possibly just making random
notes. In
that case,
it's not just yes or no. It's kind of the breakdown of the jury's deliberation. So it's more specific, but I think it lends force to the idea that when the jury already says it's confused, which happened in Nelson and happened here, we can take these clues about how their deliberations went to see if the error is harmless.
Wasn't that verdict sheet the verdict sheet on the penalty phase in Nelson?
Uh-huh.
And isn't that...
Yes. It's not a perfect analogy. I just offer it as another example.
But cross-outs, I mean, isn't that a dangerous business? No one should know outside of that jury what goes on in that room, and notes are taken all the maybe meaningless, things are crossed out. If we start down the road of, in any case, and it may help the state or it may help the defendant in a given case, in any case of trying to read those tea leaves, it's a would you agree it's a dangerous exercise?
Potentially. This is a really unique case. This court has never been faced with a case before where charges completely omitted from the verdict sheet. That's why this is not Galicia. This is why this is not Gandhi. This is a very unusual error. And in trying now, we're trying to discern the tea leaves now. The jury didn't have the opportunity to return a second-degree verdict, and we're sitting here saying, but did they want to? You know, so as we're trying, could they have wanted to? Is there a rational basis for this? We're already coming from behind.
Well, and rational basis versus did they want to are two different questions. You would agree
sure,
with that?
Sure, but we're still, there's a question that should have gone to the jury, and instead of leaving it to the jury, now we're trying to figure out what the jury could have done when it should have gone to the jury in the first place.
Would you like to address the sentencing question?
Briefly, I want to say one thing about remedy, and then I'll move to sentencing.
Question.
Mr. Cuff opposes the state's request to mold, and he relies on Federico for authority to oppose that. He'd like a new day in court where he's not facing all these other charges all at once and another co-defendant who's pointing the finger at him.
May I ask one last question before
yes.
you move on to sentencing? Would your argument be the same with regard to the seriousness of this failing regarding the verdict sheet and no second-degree kidnapping listing on the questions if the jury had not asked its question of the court?
Probably. But
Tell me how you would make the same.
If there's a
argument.
Rational basis, the lesser included needs to be charged, right? So that's our kind of black letter premise. So as long as there's a rational basis, I would be up here saying the failure to allow the jury to return a charge that there was a rational basis to give is harmful error. But I do think...
Would it be harmful then with regard to the other kidnapping charge involving the other child where the first degree crime was found not guilty and they went to a lesser degree but not a second degree?
Oh, the wife.
Yeah.
You know, the wife is interesting. I can't fully... We don't know what juries do, why they do. The co-conspirator who...
I'm trying to understand how you're discerning this record, and it seems to me that pivotal to your argument is the jury question that has come back.
If there's a rational basis, a charge needs to be given. So pivotal, the core of my argument is that there's a rational basis for this charge. I think
if
the
there's no rational basis, then your argument fails.
Yeah, I can't win if there's not a rational
basis.
Okay. I don't know how I could get up here and say anything else, though. If someone has a, you know,
so it really doesn't depend on the jury's question. It hinges on the rational basis or not in the facts of this case.
I think the jury's question is a really important clue that not only was there a rational basis in this case, but this jury wanted to return this charge. This jury thought second-degree kidnapping was the appropriate charge, and it wasn't allowed to.
We're really speculating when we go down that
road. That's why the core is rational basis. So that's the core of my argument. I'm not sitting here saying that even if there's no rational basis, somehow he could prevail on failing to have this charge here. So to move on to sentencing, Mr. Cuff was convicted of one robbery, this home invasion we're discussing, one conspiracy, which was later reversed on appeal, and two nonviolent charges stemming from a car stop. The trial court ran 9 charges consecutively and 3 concurrently. The result was that Mr. Cuff, a 29-year-old with only 2 prior nonviolent indictable convictions, was sentenced to 98 years in prison with a 66.4-year period of parole ineligibility. In other words, he was sentenced to be in prison until he was, at the very least, 95 and a half years old. That's a life sentence. So in Yarbo, of course, this court laid out the guidelines, factors and guidelines, that the court has to take into account when deciding whether to sentence someone to concurrent or consecutive sentences. This court paid lip service to Yarbo, but failed to actually analyze and apply Yarbo. And there's 3 main ways that I think these failings are clear in the record. The first is that the court repeatedly emphasized a factor not found in Yarbo, that the elements of this offense are separate and distinct from other offenses, and that the crimes were separate and distinct from other crimes. That's not a Yarbo factor. That's a given whenever someone is convicted of more than one offense. So to use that given, that's going to be present in every situation where a judge has to decide whether to impose consecutive or concurrent, as a reason to impose consecutive is very troubling. The second, that was without explanation, the trial court violated the 5th guideline, that ordinarily the sentences from 2 offenses shouldn't be the same length. The 2 kidnappings got the same charge. It's not a rule that cannot be broken, but a court must explain why it's diverging from the guidelines. And third, as to the actual Yarbo factors, there's a few factors that the trial court really just didn't consider. The first is that many of the crimes shared the same objective. Within the Patel incident, all of those crimes shared the same objective, to get money and to get away. Within the Gola incident, they all shared the same objective, to get money. And the trial court also didn't consider that the crimes were committed so closely in time as to indicate a period of aberrant behavior. This is important both within each incident, within the Patel incident, within the car stop incident, within the goal incident, but also among. In the sentencing transcript earlier from pages 22 to 27, the trial court used that this was done, these five crimes were committed during a very short time period, a crime spree, to find aggravating factors 3 and 9, that Mr. Cuff was likely to reoffend and that there was a special need to deter him, but then didn't consider those same facts later in the Yarbo analysis, when those facts could maybe be helpful to Mr. Cuff. But again, they at least needed to be considered, whether or not the trial court would find that they apply.
I have a question about the Gola incident. The children are restrained, and then later the adults are restrained. Can you tell us the amount of time and the difference between those two events based on the record?
The record's a little shaky, but it looks like about an hour. I'm also not standing up here and saying there is no cause for any consecutive sentences that any judge could rationally impose in this case.
So was the imposition of consecutive sentences with regard to the children as distinct from the adults, the lengthier sentences that are at the core of this case, inappropriate for Gola?
I am going to resist the idea that we can say that some of these are okay and some of these aren't okay when the process overall wasn't followed properly. And the reason I'm going to resist that is because Yarbo established procedures that seek to further real substantive goals. And so if the process wasn't followed in the totality of the sentencing, taking bits and pieces of it to say, well, this was done okay here, I think is contrary to the purpose of Yarbo. But I would concede that in a proper sentencing with a proper Yarbo analysis, it's quite likely that a judge would maybe run those particular offenses consecutive, as was done in this case.
So why don't you tell us what you think the appropriate sentence could have been under a Yarbo analysis? Which of these 9 consecutives should have been running concurrent?
So I think the 3 from the Patel incident should probably have been run concurrent. I think that the 2 from the car stop probably should have been run concurrent. Sorry, I'm just grabbing my little chart. I think that the unlawful possession of a weapon should have been run concurrent in the Gola incident. And I'm uncomfortable with the same length of the 2 kidnappings because of the 5th Yarbo guideline. So if there were to be run consecutive, I think one of them should probably be brought down, which if this court reverses on the first issue, then obviously that's going to look different anyway. I do want to mention as to victims, because I know we're talking about that, and obviously that is a Yarbo factor. Obviously the trial court did consider that. This court made clear in Carey that yes, sometimes that might be the most important determination, and it can justify consecutive sentences even if no other factor does, after a thorough qualitative Yarbo analysis when the trial court explains that. So even though victims could be enough to run some of these consecutive, the whole Yarbo analysis needs to be done right. And I would note that, of course, in Patel and in the car stop, there's 1 victim each. So that can't justify everything that happened here.
You said in response to the question that the 3 Patel charges should have been run together.
Yes.
Address whether the armed robbery 18-year sentence in Patel should have been consecutive to the Gola incident.
To the Gola? I would be hard-pressed to say that as a matter of law, none of these 3 incidents could be run consecutively to each other. I do think, because of the other Yarbo, they're not the guidelines and not the factors, but they're the principles of Yarbo, that punishment should fit the crime, that there be a predictable degree of uniformity in sentencing, and that sentencing concern a single, not a multiple human being. I do think that when these sentences might be otherwise justifiable, when someone who is 29 years old with no prior violent crimes ends up in prison for life when he has never been in prison a day in his life before, for incidents that, while harrowing and traumatic, I am sure, no one was physically injured in these crimes, that's not predictable. I could not have predicted the sentence based on my experience in sentencing and based on the charges here. And it's not uniform. I have had clients who have killed people, some of them 1, some of them more than 1. that have gotten significantly lower sentences. Even for his parole ineligibility, he is never going to see daylight again.
Even now, if we run a number of these charges concurrently, as you suggest, Mr. Cuff may do no better than 60 years.
Well, I think that if some of these are run consecutive, the top number is still going to be quite high, but he might have a chance at seeing daylight outside of a prison ever again, which matters. And it particularly matters when he had never been in prison a day in his life before. To go from nothing to 99.5 years old is a lot for a 29-year-old.
Anything else you'd like to add?
I want to just add one more thing. I know that the state asks that this court affirm anyway, and I think this court made clear in Sutton and in Miller that those have to be the exception and not the rule, cases where this court affirms despite the fact that the Yarbo analysis just wasn't adequate. And the reason this can't be that case is three reasons. The first, it was woefully inadequate, not just a little inadequate. Some of the factors just weren't considered. And the resulting sentences kind of don't make any sense. Possession of the armed robbery, possession of the arm used in an armed robbery consecutive to the armed robbery doesn't make a lot of sense. The second is just the length of the sentence. I don't think this is the case where we can gamble on this was kind of good enough. But third, I just want to point this court to the amount of discretion in this case. If everything was run consecutively minimum, 15 years, right, is the lowest he could have gotten, and the higher sentence was up to 150 years, maybe passed. It's a wide range of judicial discretion, and the reason this court decided Yarbo is to channel that discretion. So in a case where there is so much discretion, the proper channeling through the Yarbo factors, which again are a procedure, but they were designed to make these substantive goals, is particularly important. So I would ask that that this court remand this for a full resentencing hearing.
Can I ask you one last question? You know, of course, that the legislature took off the cap on the total consecutive sentences on Yarbo. Do you think that going back to Roth, when Justice O'Hearn talked about shock the judicial conscience being something that would be rarely invoked, that aspirational belief perhaps needs to be revisited in the context of no cap in a Yarbo setting?
Absolutely. I think something needs to be done when these, and I cite a ton of cases in my brief, and I go to SOAs all the time. Like, Yarbo is just blazed through often, and these sentences get really long. And the incantation you see most often is no free crimes, which, mm-hmm. as courts and Rogers, easier said than done. And I think this is an opportunity for this court to, either by revisiting the factor or articulating some importance, again, reaffirming these other principles, that we need to rebalance Yarbo and how it's done, because it's leaning very far in. As long as I can say no free crimes, then I can just stack them, and there needs to be some balance.
Well, one of the things the court can do is look at the overall sentence.
Yes.
There should be a real focus on that.
And I petitioned on excessiveness here, and I was invited to focus on consecutiveness, mm-hmm. but I do think that Yarbo does embrace the aggregate, clearly, when you read Yarbo. And I would say that not only was the process for each consecutive sentence here not followed, but we have to look at this result. This result is too much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lehrer. Ms. Sullivan.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm going to focus on defendants' two main points in their argument, first starting with the omission of second-degree kidnapping on the verdict sheet. The state's position is that this omission of second-degree kidnapping from the verdict sheet was harmless. Based upon the jury's verdict sheet, aside from any speculation that might be made, the jury found the defendant guilty of first-degree kidnapping. They were also polled, during which all of them agreed that the defendant was guilty, and this was a very careful jury. This was always a first-degree kidnapping case. Nobody at trial made the argument that it was second-degree rather than first-degree. Consistent with that, the defense argued during trial that this was a case of identity rather than whether it was a second- or first-degree case. Going to defendants' arguments about release, the state would submit that no rational jury could have found the defendant guilty of second-degree in this case because he did not release his victims. The victims had their hands tied with zip ties. Specifically, the facts that were brought out about Gideon Gola, that his hands were zip tied behind his back. And what the interesting thing about zip ties is that you need a sharp instrument to cut those zip ties. So it's not something that would be easily released. And with the kidnapping statute, I think that the appropriate focus would be on the defendant's action, that he did not intend to release his victims. And it should not be an incentive to focus on the victims or how they find the victims. It really should be a focus on what the defendant did in the case. Unless the court has any questions, I would like to move to the sentencing point and just point out that this was a thorough discourse.
Are you inviting questions on this first?
Yes, I would, Your Honor.
If there was no rational basis, why wasn't the state making an argument, Judge, you don't have to charge second degree, there's no rational basis?
From reading the record, Your Honor, I think second degree was charged because it's part of the model of first degree. Second degree is subsumed into the elements of first degree kidnapping, so I think it was just charged that way.
But you're representing the prosecutor's office. No one jumped up and said no second degree. So second degree was charged.
Second degree was charged, but my argument.
But now you're arguing there's no rational basis, but there was no such argument at the trial level.
There was no argument from either side. There was no defense that this was a second degree rather than a first. Nobody objected to the verdict sheet. It was charged, and second degree was not on the verdict sheet. We understand that. That really just brings us to a question of whether it was harmful in this case.
So this is, obviously there's no rational basis, that's the end of it. But assuming that there is a rational basis, based on our jurisprudence, we have said that the jury should not be left with an all or nothing. And when the lesser included is not charged, that will result in a reversal, yes?
Well, I would submit on Galicia and Gandhi that those cases are on point because where there is an error, it could be determined whether it's harmless. In this case, consistent with the proofs and what was submitted at trial and the fact that there was no argument that this was a second degree case at trial, based on the proofs, it's really just that last element.
So
is this a harmless error argument or a plain error? No one raised it, no one objected. So
exactly.
We would analyze it under plain error, not harmless error, would we not?
Yes.
But even under plain error, we have said in our jurisprudence that the judge has to make certain that justice is done. Like the state may want first degree, the defense may want acquittal. The judge's charge is to make certain that the jury knows all of the applicable charges and the lesser charges. And in this particular case, the jury actually came out and said, well, what about second degree? And the judge said, hey, just look at the verdict sheet. Be guided by the verdict sheet. And the verdict sheet only had first degree, even though he had charged second degree. How could they not be confused?
I don't think the jury was confused in here. And they didn't ask for I know counsel had brought up maybe proposing a definition of released. The jury never asked for a definition of released in here. And that's what the distinction is between first and second degree. But going to the question that the jury did in fact ask, they said, if applicable, how do we denote second degree? So we don't know whether they were actually considering it or not. It said, if applicable. We don't know which charge they were talking about. There was a number of counts in this case. And they also didn't say if they were coming out on guilty or not guilty. I don't think that the jury, which was very careful, they obviously recognized going through all of these. It went through the state's proofs when it found that the state didn't satisfy its burden. It acquitted him of a number of charges. And it went down to lesser included as well in finding Leah Golda, that the crimes that happened to her that were only false imprisonment. I don't think this verdict sheet
misled
the jury.
We really don't know. We're guessing. The state may have been harmed on some of these cases where there were findings of not guilty on kidnapping. The jury not having the opportunity of finding second degree may have actually opted for this all or nothing. We just don't know. Would you agree with that?
And I don't think that...
Would you agree with that?
I agree. I agree that when the state's proofs didn't meet certain crimes, it may have acquitted. But also, we can easily speculate that that question of, if applicable, how do we denote second degree, might have gone to the Leogola. They might have acquitted him of first degree, and noting that there was no second degree on the verdict sheet, it then considered the lessers included, which went down to false imprisonment.
But that concession points to the real problem with there not being the charge. The jury shouldn't have been going to either an acquittal or something below second degree or something higher without the appropriate second degree kidnapping charge.
And let me be clear, I'm not conceding the fact that my argument is that we should not engage in speculation. My argument is consistent with the proofs, the first degree was well supported in the jury, what they found. If you want to engage in speculation and look at the verdict sheet, then I'm saying that it's as easily to engage in speculation as to say that they could have gone up. You could go down, and it could have applied to legal.
But you're not advocating either way, because either way we are in the land of guesswork.
And I'm saying that the court should not engage in speculation.
Let me ask you as a broader question beyond the facts of your case. Given the I think we can surmise that at least in some cases verdict sheets take over the process. It's there. It's perhaps structuring the discussions. And if there's an omission on the verdict sheet, it may turn out to be, just generally speaking, a significant omission and might cause the jury to not go through an exercise that it should have gone through if it were following the charge directly. Do we need more reminders to courts and counsel about the importance of walking through the charge and comparing it with the verdict sheet and making sure that there are no omissions?
And I would understand that. I don't think it's a problem to point out the importance of the verdict sheet, but I think there is case law that the verdict sheet is an aid to the charge, that the charge is the roadmap and that the verdict sheet is a guide to that.
Right, but when you think about, and I've never been a juror, obviously, and perhaps there are people in this room who have, but as a juror, a verdict sheet would certainly be an important document for you and walking you. There are things to check off that someone has that helps guide the jury. It's a very important document in the deliberations. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, and I would note that particular this case, this was a careful jury, like I mentioned. They were pointing out things as minor as typos. They were really looking at this verdict sheet, and they did ask a question. They said, you know, how do we denote second degree? So if we were to say that it went to the kidnapping, and I think that they probably, and I think counsel had pointed this out below, they were probably really focused on the charge itself, and they noticed that there was a difference of first and second degree kidnapping that might not have been reflected
on
the verdict sheet.
That this was a foul one. I mean, the judge charges second degree and doesn't put second degree kidnapping on the verdict sheet. That's a major error. Would you agree?
It is an error, but in this case, it's harmless.
So in assessing that, I want you to focus a little bit more on the meaning of release in the statute itself, because it sounded earlier as though you were suggesting that by virtue of the fact that zip ties were used, you cannot find anything other than restraint. Do we look only at the type of restraint, or should we look at the way in which it was applied?
I think it is a factual determination that I think the jury has to make based on the facts in the case. But I think that the focus should be on the defendant's actions and what he did. We don't always have to look at the instrument that he used to restrain his victims. I know in this case zip ties were used. Also cases which are before this court right now, they used different wires from TVs and VCRs, things that they found of that nature. But I think really the focus is on the defendant's actions. He didn't intend to release his victim.
So if the defendant applied zip ties or some other type of restraint in a way that they could be immediately removed, how does that factor in?
Well, I think with one of the justices that mentioned, it might just be a matter that he had tied them poorly in that instance. Maybe he should tie them better, but his intent all along was to keep his victims restrained.
Well, is that a jury question?
I think it is a jury question. And in this case, the jury determined, based on that last element that was included in the first-degree first-degree verdict, that the defendant did not release his victims unharmed, and in a safe place. This verdict sheet actually required that the state prove both, while the model charge only requires either or.
What was the level of proof as to the victims having been unharmed?
Unharmed?
What did the state present?
Well, I think it was not a question of whether there was any physical harm to the Golas. There was no physical harm. I would submit that I think the jury could have found that there was significant psychological harm that would have happened in these cases. These people were ambushed in their homes. The children were held for an hour before their parents came home. And then, obviously, Mrs. Gola, the wife, she was having a severe reaction to the home invasion.
So we know that these circumstances, of course, could lead to serious emotional or psychological harm. The argument that your colleague has presented is that the state didn't come forward and offer proof on that question.
A couple things about that. This isn't a sufficiency of evidence argument. Their argument really is just that second degree wasn't an option on the verdict sheet. But at trial, nobody argued that. Neither defense counsel argued that these victims weren't, I think at one point in their opening or their closing, they said nobody contested that these victims were brutalized. It was just a question of ID. And everybody had that focus. So nobody was really bringing up those elements of whether these people had severe psychological harm.
But that still goes to whether or not, therefore, there was a rational basis. Obviously, the judge thought so, and everyone did, because second degree. This is an unusual, where the defense is shooting for the stands, and so is the state. But our jurisprudence has repeatedly said, despite the fact that the state and defense are going for the extremes, the jury has to be charged with all offenses that are rationally based on the evidence. So that doesn't change. So the jury should not be denied the opportunity of returning second degree, regardless of what the state or defense is arguing. Isn't that our jurisprudence?
I understand that, but in this case, my argument, yes, there was an error in the verdict sheet. It wasn't there. They would have never reached second degree because they found all of the elements of first degree. They found in that last element on the verdict sheet that the victims were not released unharmed and in a safe place. Going back to the question previously about the harm, the way that I read the law on this about concerning how it was set up on the verdict sheet, I think release modified both the unharmed and in a safe place. I don't even think we get to that because they weren't released.
So if an occupant of a home is tied up with Ziplocs, removed from the home, and then returned to the home with the Ziplocs, under those circumstances, would a jury be able to consider that the victim was released unharmed in a safe place, their own home?
No, I don't think you
don't think there would be a rational basis
to find that they were released in a safe place? I don't think so.
Taken and returned to their home with the same Ziplocs, unharmed.
I don't think there should be an incentive for defendants to attack people in their own homes.
So of course there isn't, but one of the reasons for the second degree is to encourage the defendant not to harm the person and to bring the person back or to release the person safely. That's the whole purpose, is it not, of
yes.
That feature.
If someone were tied up in their home and somebody who lived alone, they could end up dying there. I mean,
yes.
this is not a safe situation to leave someone constrained, especially if there's nobody else around. Obviously, there are multiple people in these offenses.
And it's very likely that they can have a reaction just as Leah Gola did, as there was testimony at trial, she was having trouble breathing, she couldn't turn off the alarm, that she was having
severe reaction. Of course, that can happen in every case, but the statute still encourages the person. No one's saying that this isn't terrible. Everything that happened here was terrible. But the statute is still somehow encouraging the defendant to place the person unharmed in a safe place.
Released.
Right. Is it? Are we conflating two things? Bringing them back to the home, even if you leave them tied up in the home, they're not released. If you take them outside, you bring them back to home, you might bring them back to a safe place, but you still haven't released them. They're two separate concepts, aren't they?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think release is what I'm saying is modifying both the in a safe place and unharmed.
And first degree kidnapping charges have been sustained by this court when someone has been tied up and moved from one place within a home to another, correct?
I don't know any of those cases.
I can think of an instance where a husband was moved.
Let's go on to the second point.
Yes, Your Honor. With Yarborough, the state would submit that this was a thorough discourse on the Yarborough factors, that it was done correctly, and that it's an illustration of the principle that there should be no free crimes. The trial court here thoroughly outlined her reasons as to each of the crimes, why she was running them concurrent and consecutive. And her rationale about running the two victims that were teenagers who were upstairs and the two parents who were downstairs, she ran each of them concurrent to each other and then consecutive to each other. And in that, she's recognizing the fact that she has a duty under Yarborough to take into those considerations, those factors. The trial court also ran the first-degree robbery concurrent to the Gideon kidnapping because she recognized that under Yarborough she has to consider those factors, and her rationale was well supported by the record.
Let's start with Patel. Can you explain why it was appropriate to run the sentence for armed robbery and for possession of a weapon consecutive to one another?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the sentencing judge explained her reasons for that. She cited DeLuca for saying that the cases did not merge. She did say that they had separate and distinct elements. And I think that she also said that there's no free crimes. This was an unlawful possession of a weapon without a permit, and I believe that that offense could have happened at any point prior to the robbery, prior to the time that he decided to use it in an armed robbery, and that really it goes to a regulatory offense of punishing a person for having a gun without a permit, which is separate apart from what they decide to use it for later on.
Why don't you speak to the Gola incident as well, the possession of a weapon charge in particular?
The possession of a weapon was different from the robbery. The robbery ran concurrent, but it was different from the kidnapping. I think that it was clear how the victims were suffering in this case, the two teenagers were ambushed by the defendants an hour earlier than their parents. They were separate. They were upstairs. They waited for their parents. Downstairs, when the parents eventually came home, the father was on his way upstairs, and he was dragged downstairs by the armed gunman, and the money was demanded down there.
So that would arguably justify the consec sentences for the two sets, the children and the parents. But why as to the possession of a weapon?
Well, I think, again, that's a separate offense of possession of a weapon without without a permit, and that he could have possessed that weapon long before the kidnappings. So I believe that that was an appropriate sentence because it's a separate and distinct crime from either the kidnappings.
Look, these are awful crimes. No one's suggesting anything other than that. But it seems to me, from reviewing hundreds, and now maybe thousands of sentences, there doesn't seem to be among our trial courts any sort of consistency in the handing out of consecutive sentences. 9 consecutive sentences here, another judge might have done 4 consecutive sentences. You can always rationalize the way you're rationalizing right now that these are distinct offenses. And you can argue that they're distinct, that all of these are somehow distinct. But should we be stringing together in a case like this 9 consecutive sentences to reach a 99-year sentence?
I recognize it's a long sentence, but there's 3 different sets of crimes that occurred. I mean, you get a long sentence.
But what's enough? At some point, what 99? Wouldn't 60 years be enough?
It's a lawful sentence.
Or is 60 years too lenient a sentence in a case like this? Would you argue that?
I think that we are not supposed to second guess what the trial court does. It's a deferential review. The trial court followed the Yarborough analysis. She outlined the factors before she engaged in them. She recognized her duty under the sentencing laws. And it's a discretionary decision to impose that sentence.
Other questions? Anything you'd like to add?
We would just rely on the briefs and ask that this court affirm. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Sivnikova.
May it please the court. If I may briefly address the question posed to the state about the release unharmed element, I just wanted, in support of state's position and the Attorney General's position, to point out that the jury really did consider the release unharmed factor, which is demonstrated by the fact that the acquitted defendant on first-degree kidnapping in Gola home invasion on first-degree kidnapping of Leah Gola. Actually, there was conflicting testimony in this case by cooperating co-conspirator and by Mr. Gola himself. Mr. Gola testified that his wife was tied up, and co-conspirator Jerome Thomas testified that she was not, and the jury actually considered that, and they gave deference to co-conspirators' testimony, and they acquitted defendant on first-degree kidnapping.
And you may have been harmed. Because there wasn't a second degree. Had there been a second degree, the jury may have returned a second degree. It may not have gone to a lesser.
Yes,
Your Honor. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. That is the point. That is the point I'm making. That instead.
Well, then if you are harmed on one occasion, then why wasn't the defendant maybe harmed on another occasion?
Because the jury actually considered the elements of the offense. They were not posed the question, do you find defendant guilty of first or second degree kidnapping? They were presented with the questions outlining the three questions, which were the elements of the first degree kidnapping. And without finding either one of these elements, they could not have convicted defendant on first degree kidnapping. But in this case, where they could have found defendant potentially guilty of second degree kidnapping, they went on to lesser included offense of false imprisonment, which prejudices the state, perhaps, but not defendant. Also, the submission of a second-degree kidnapping from the verdict sheet, it was not objected to by anybody, and therefore it is reviewed under the plain error standard, which requires the showing that there was potential for producing unjust results. And this court actually ruled before that the oral instructions of the court are sufficient for the jury to understand, if the oral instructions of the court are sufficient for the jury to understand the elements of the crime and the verdict sheet is not misleading, then any error on the verdict sheet can be deemed harmless. And while this court did encourage the completeness and
I'm sorry, I just don't understand that. The oral instructions obviously were correct here. The court charged second degree, and there's no place on the verdict sheet to check off second degree. So how could that not be harmful? They have no place to actually record their vote for second degree as charged.
And where they did not find that each element of this first degree was satisfied, they had no choice but to acquit.
Is your argument that if there had, even if there was no second degree, if they had not found the first degree, all three elements, then they would have been not guilty, like the other ones that were found not guilty? So that the second degree didn't actually affect that. Had they not found that, they would have just found not guilty rather than going down to second degree, and they found all three elements of first degree when they worked through the verdict sheet. Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor, that is our argument. And actually, there's no question that the judge gave a very thorough instruction as to elements of first degree, second degree, and lesser included offenses, and instructed the jury that they were not to answer the questions on lesser included or to render verdict on lesser included unless they found that each element of the charged offense was satisfied. And the charged offense in this case was the first degree kidnapping, which demonstrates that they did find each element was satisfied when they convicted defendant of first degree kidnapping. And again, since the jury was not considering the degrees of the offenses but rather the elements of the offense, it is clear that all the elements were satisfied. And as I said, the jury acquitted defendant of first-degree kidnapping in Leah Gola case and convicted him of three first-degree kidnappings in the case of her husband, Gideon Gola, and their two teenage daughters. And so there was no prejudice to defendant where he was acquitted instead of being convicted of a second-degree kidnapping, which still carried a very lengthy prison term. As for the sentencing, the trial judge engaged in a thorough 16-page long analysis in applying all the aggravating mitigating factors and Yarbrough analysis. And considering the circumstances of the case, the fact that there were five separate victims in this case, and the sentence did not shock the judicial conscience, and it should be affirmed. And as for Justice Albin's question regarding the gun offenses, unlawful possession of a weapon offenses, as to why they ran consecutively, the state does have a strong interest in deterring gun offenses, and that's why we have such extensive sentences and we have Graves Act as to deter unlawful possession of weapons.
But the question is not whether it could be made consecutive, but was it an abuse of discretion to have done so in this instance in light of the lengthy sentences already being ascribed to each incident individually as well as the sentence totally?
It is our position that the sentence here does fit the crime, that there were multiple victims, there were several incidents, and there was not abuse of discretion on trial judge's behalf.
What do you think this court's aim was in writing the Yarbrough opinion?
To make sure that the sentences are consistent.
Thank you.
From your perch in the Attorney General's office, with respect to consecutive sentences, do you see consistency across the state in the way consecutive sentences are imposed?
Yes, we do.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Laird.
I'm going to make two really quick points. The first is that it is always the case in an appeal when we are up here saying a lesser included offense should have been given and wasn't given, that the jury convicted on the greater. So the state's argument that, oh, they convicted of first degree, which means they found each of the elements of first degree, that is always the case when we're up here. And this court has said consistently for decades, that's not enough, because the language from the case law is that the jury is forced into an unreasonable choice when the right answer isn't there for them, when all the options aren't there for them. And the final thing I'll say is Yarbrough is not a checklist. And I do think that this is a really important opportunity for this court to reaffirm, as this court did in State v. Case. It's not just whether the sentence is legal, it's whether it was gotten there properly, and that is a substantive inquiry, not just a checklist. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take that.